You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we are coming to you live. So whether you're streaming live from 3cr.org.au or listening back on to a podcast, wherever you are, thank you for joining us today. And you're joined today by myself, Jacob Andrewafer.
And Mary Merkinich. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Jacob. Do you want me to start with the acknowledgement?
Yeah, just get started.
Okay, so 3CR and Green Left acknowledges that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung. They are the rightful sovereign owners, they're storytellers and caretakers of the land. They never ceded sovereignty, and colonisation continues to this day. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and the right to their land. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mary. So to go into what we have lined up for our program, and we have quite a big program this week, because always, as with every Friday, every week, there's always lots to kind of cover in terms of news. So given the kind of recent attacks and threats against Cuba, we've decided to have Alan Jennings, who's a Socialist Alliance member and longtime solidarity activist with Latin America. Specifically, Alan has a lot of knowledge about the history of Cuba. And so we're going to be having a bit of discussion with Alan for our first interview to talk a bit about the history of US attacks on Cuba, just to give some of our listeners a bit of that history and context. And then we're going to be following some of the developments in terms of the war in Iran, which actually, just a bit of a recent update on that. Probably many listeners would probably be aware that, you know, Trump and Iran were kind of reaching some kind of agreement in terms of ending the war, but they have since exchanged some fire against each other. So the war doesn't appear to have an end in sight. So we're going to be speaking to Ali Keshta, who's an Iranian-Australian writer and political activist based in Melbourne, and he's going to be giving us a bit of insights into some of the current developments around that have happened with the United States war against Iran. Then we're going to be speaking with Ethan Floyd, who's based in Gadigal land, and he was part of the Global Samud Flotilla. Probably many of our listeners would be aware that many of the people who came who are on the Global Samud Flotilla have now actually come back home and experienced, you know, some really horrific abuse and torture at the hands of the Israeli Defense Force, also known as the Israeli Occupation Forces. Maybe I'll pass it on to Mary to kind of start off with a bit of a headline news discussion in terms of what's happening in Gaza and Lebanon.
Well, the news is not good. So Netanyahu apparently overnight announced that he now wants 70% of Gaza, which is an increase from, I think it was 60% previously, which was still outrageous. And, of course, the attacks on Lebanon have continued. Something like almost a quarter of Lebanon's population has been displaced. Lots of people have been injured and killed, and hundreds of health workers have been targeted by Israel as they did when they were attacking Gaza. Sorry, I shouldn't say when they were. They still are. I heard a Lebanese doctor talking about what was happening in Lebanon, and he described something that he called two attacks. I think that's the word that he used. Anyway, basically it just means that Israel attacks an area and then they wait, and then people come in to help those that are injured, especially health workers, and then Israel attacks again so that they can target the health workers, which of course is the intention of that, is to put pressure on people to move so that Israel can move in, to make it as uncomfortable, as horrific as possible. I don't know whatever news you've heard about what's going on, Jacob.
Yeah, so just to kind of add to your story, I mean, what's happening in Lebanon is truly horrific, especially in terms of, you know, what Israel is essentially getting away with with the support of the United States and the West. And the next update I want to kind of give is also what's happening in Gaza. And there's just been a recent news update that Benjamin Netanyahu has directed Israel's military to take over 70% of Gaza. Now, this, to give you a bit of context, Israel essentially controls up to 65% of Gaza. And this follows the kind of truce that was, you know, brokered in October at the end of last year. You know, but since then, you know, more than 900 Palestinians have been murdered by Israel, despite the fact there is supposed to be this quote unquote ceasefire in place. And so essentially, Israel is now wanting to basically seize more than 70% of the Palestinian territory. And what I think this kind of reflects is very much, I think, the settler colonial kind of ambitions of the Israeli state, while they're essentially implementing a kind of slow kind of genocide of the Palestinian people, and they're very much trying to forcibly take parts of Gaza bit by bit, to the point where there'll be no more areas in Gaza that are essentially controlled by Palestinians. And of course, that's in the context of the fact that the percentage of Gaza that they already occupy has already been, you know, has been bombarded to ruins by Israel's 2-year, you know, genocide against the Palestinians. And so, yeah, I think this is, we have to kind of extend all the kind of solidarity and really call this out as, you know, what is it, the fact that Israel is allowed to continue to act with impunity, you know, I think has to be opposed.
Yeah, absolutely. And no governments have done anything about it, anything serious about it, including, of course, our own government.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the fact that while we're going to be talking a bit about this with Ethan Floyd later, but, you know, the fact that while, you know, it was interesting to note that Penny Wong was willing to condemn that video that came from Ben Jiver. The fact that the far right sort of Israeli minister who taunted openly the flotilla participants while they were basically imprisoned and taken hostage by the Israeli occupation forces. You know, the fact that, yeah, Penny Wong can condemn that, but actually can't or has nothing to say about the fact that Israel is taking over more and more more of Gaza and continuing to kill Palestinians, I think, is an absolute disgrace.
Well, and they could impose sanctions on Israel. They could stop our contribution towards weapons that the Israelis are using. But none of that has happened. So words are a start, but it's a very weak start.
Absolutely.
And I guess she, you know, seeing that video of Australians just meant that she had to say something. It was just, yeah.
Mm. All right. Well, I might go play a quick announcement. We'll finish up this news discussion, and we might play a quick news. We'll play a quick announcement, and then we'll go on to one song to give a bit of a brief for the program, and then we will start our interview with Alan Jennings to talk about the history of U.S. intervention in Cuba. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
All right. So I thought I'd play a track by Hiatus Kyote. And this song is called Nakamura. And so Hiatus Kyote is a Melbourne-based kind of jazz, kind of fusion sort of band. So yeah, hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
You, I
All right. You're just listening to Nakamura by Hiatus Coyote. Now, we're now going into our first interview for the program. So we are very happy to be joined by Alan Jennings, who is a longtime solidarity activist with Latin America. He is also a Socialist Alliance member and has also, you know, had some experience of spending time in Cuba and Nicaragua. And we have Alan on to kind of have a bit of a discussion, to give a bit of a kind of insight into some of the history of, you know, some of the of US intervention in Cuba since the Cuban Revolution in 1959. So good morning, Alan.
Morning, Jacob.
Good morning, Alan. It's Mary here.
Oh, hi, Mary.
Sorry, I'm not able to hear you.
Oh, yeah. I should have fixed it. Yeah, you should. That should work.
Okay, okay. Okay, so, Alan, our first question is, it's sort of a three-pronged question, actually. Firstly, how did the early US economic sanctions and trade restrictions after the 59 Cuban Revolution impact Cuba? And how did the government of Castro and Che Guevara respond to those attacks? How has the prolonged embargo of Cuba also impacted Cuba?
Yeah, that's a big one. I mean, that's a key question. But yeah, I mean, ironically, this all started, it's not initially in 1959, but sort of into the middle of the next year, 1960, when the United States was sending oil, petroleum to Cuba and decided to stop that and prohibited oil being sent to Cuba in the middle of 1960. As the Cuban government sort of got on its way and started to implement some of its laws, including the agrarian reform. And U.S. companies were fearful of losing their assets and losing their land in Cuba. And so they stopped sending oil to Cuba, and USSR stepped in and provided crude oil. And then the United States actually prohibited private refineries from refining that crude oil. And as a response to that, the Cubans, you know, this was headed by Fidel Castro at the time, the Cubans then privatized those oil refineries. And that was the beginning of a complete trade embargo of the country in 1960. And it's lasted since then, which is, you know, the longest trade embargo in modern history, at least. And you think about the effects of this. 80% of Cuba's trade at the time was with the US, and that just went to zero overnight. So all of the things that you import, all the equipment, all the materials, all the food, all the everything, stopped. And so, you know, there was not only trade, but also US citizens had been banned from visiting Cuba. And worse still, third-party countries have been sanctioned if they continue to trade with Cuba. So it's more than just the trade embargo. And this has really restricted Cuba's ability to develop, you know, just thinking of all the equipment and food and resources they need to develop their country. And their initial major response was to, you know, shift over time all of their trade to the Soviet Union. And this is in the context of the Cold War at the time. So, you know, then they went from a major economic change to shift their trade to the Soviet Union. And also being, I mean, really creative and really inventive with what they did with their meagre resources or their restricted resources. I mean, you know, for example, the famous US-made 1950s cars, which is still around in Cuba at the moment, the Cadillacs and the Fords and the Pontiacs, you know, they learned to make the parts themselves and continue to maintain these cars, and they're still going today. This is cars from the 1950s, but They've struggled, and of course it got worse in the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed and they had to do the same thing again, diversifying their trade. The whole world sees this, almost the whole world sees this as illegal and damaging and, you know, destructive to the people of Cuba. And the United Nations every year votes on this trade embargo, and almost every country opposes it, even Australia, believe it or not, because it is an attack on the people of Cuba, and it's illegal.
Hmm. So I want to go, into kind of the next kind of question. One of the most kind of significant kind of attacks on Cuba was the whole Bay of Pigs historical kind of event. Can you tell us how the US attack was kind of defeated and what was the context for the Bay of Pigs?
Yeah, well, this was in a year after the trade embargo started in April 1961. We'll go into this a bit more, but the United States, mainly through covert actions funded by the CIA, has attempted to overthrow the government of Cuba since the beginning. The Bay of Pigs was literally a military invasion of Cuba by primarily Cuban exiles in Florida, who some 1,500 Cuban exiles who were trained and supported and funded by the CIA to literally invade the country, and they were planning to take it back. And this was literally, these people were trained, not in Florida because it was too obvious, but they were trained in Guatemala and Nicaragua, who were right-wing governments at the time. And then they sent in their boats from those countries. And on the night before, this is in April 1961, the CIA arranged to bomb the airport and try to damage some of the Cuban planes. And then the boats came in with the Cuban exiles in the morning and landed at what they call the Bay of Pigs, and attempted to come up on the beach and take over the country. But the Cubans were ready for them. They were waiting for them, and they basically walloped them. They defeated them very quickly. In 3 days, it was all over. And some 400 of the Cuban exiles, the paramilitaries, had been killed, and the rest of them were taken as prisoners and charged and imprisoned. The major thing supposedly is the U.S. or Kennedy at the time refused to or didn't want to provide any air cover for the boats, and because that would make an official air force invasion, and they basically just wiped their hands off and let these U.S.-funded paramilitaries, fall. So it really was the major attempt at an invasion of Cuba by the United States. And it remains as a point of, a very important point in Cuban history, as they basically defeated the U.S. invasion. And it remains as a shameful and clearly, negative point in U.S. history, where the USA was defeated.
Alan, you mentioned covert actions. So how extensive have these U.S. operations been to sabotage the economy and also to assassinate Cuban leaders?
It's just crazy how... the list goes on. It's just been an obsession of the U.S. to take out Fidel Castro and to take back this country. You've got the economic you know, blockade, which we've talked about. You've got the invasion, which we've just talked about, the Bay of Pigs. But you've also got hundreds of attempts to assassinate Fidel. Hundreds. I mean, we're talking at only the head of the U.S. security at the time lists and documents 638 attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, including really crazy things like poisoning his cigars when he was in New York for the UN conference. I mean, Fidel used to do scuba diving and spear fishing, and there was attempts to have shells that explode and blow him up and kill him. I mean, there's been hundreds of attempts, all failures, of course. But more than that, the CIA has organised attacks, covert attacks on Cuban infrastructure, including transport, and even things like poisoning and sabotaging sugar mills in Cuba, which is their major economic income. So, you know, the list goes on. It's just far too long to elaborate any further, but there's been many, many attempts to overthrow the government.
I want to go into kind of one of the next kind of questions, which is kind of like you've kind of just spoken about the kind of impacts of, you know, the kind of intensive kind of covert sort of US operations. But I guess I want to kind of go into the current context. What can you comment about the latest attacks by the Trump administration, and what do you think they are meant to achieve?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, we should mention here that the trade embargo has, you know, been really damaging, but it's gone to another level since the Cuban intervention in Venezuela, when, of course, they took out the Venezuelan president, and they basically have taken control of the oil in Venezuela, and that has been the source of oil for Cuba for many years. And so the embargo has worsened with the blockade of petroleum coming to Cuba, and, you know, all countries who try to do that are being sanctioned. So it's really gone to another level. This is what they've been trying to do since 1959, but it seems like now that the situation in Cuba is a lot worse, and this is what they want. Until recently, I had thought this would be another level of attempting to rely on disgruntled Cubans, spurred on by, you know, CIA, you know, provocateurs to lead protests, to actually enrage the people and against their own government and support some sort of uprising. But with the indictment last week of Raul Castro, Raul Castro is obviously Fidel Castro's brother. He was president for some 16 years and is now 94. He was indicted last week for shooting down. He was head of the Defense Forces at the time, shooting down in 1996 of some planes which were coming into U.S. Air Force airspace. So this has actually changed the discussion, because, you know, they used the excuse of Maduro, the president of Venezuela, excuse of him being a, you know, a drug trafficker or whatever. You know, some sort of lie, and it seems like they may use, well, they will use this indictment of Raul Castro as an excuse to make some sort of intervention. So I'm now more fearful of a U.S. intervention because of this indictment of Raul Castro giving them an excuse for some sort of invasion. Adding to the fact that, you know, the CIA has been in Cuba publicly and openly discussing with the current president some sort of deal. And don't forget that the current U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is Cuban origin, and for him it's a very personal thing that you know, on their watch that they get, if they get Cuba back. So, yeah, to me, it could go either way, but it's starting to look more like some sort of military intervention by the US in Cuba.
That's really worrying. That's really horrible to think that might happen. We have to wrap it up. So any final comments, Alan?
No, I think it's just, I mean, you after, you know, 67 years of an attempted, you know, the Cuban people and the Cuban government trying to do the best for their people, including supporting other countries around the world in spite of all these historical challenges, some of which I've just mentioned. I mean, they've done this amazing things in their country and they're still trying their hardest. I mean, in these most difficult moments, we really all should support Cuba. Also demand from our government to do the same.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to Alan for that. I think Jacob's just knocked something down, but we're all okay here. Thank you very much for that. Bye.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alan. Yeah, so we're just speaking to Alan Jennings about the whole history of US intervention in Cuba. And just one comment I might add is, I'm not sure if you read this, Mary, but I was looking at ABC News, there was a sort of a bit of this outrageous sort of news story, which was it basically had a kind of an article about one of the daughters of Fidel Castro, which was I don't know the specific name of the daughter, etc., but she's like, I think, in her 60s or 70s now, and she's a bit of a dissident against the Cuban government, you know, for better or worse. But I thought that it was completely outrageous in a lot of ways that, you know, she didn't really have anything really to say politically other than that she's against the Cuban government because she thinks it's all authoritarian, etc., whatever. But it's like, in the context of the fact that Cuba is currently under a massive economic blockade where people are kind of denied basic goods. People are starving without basic electricity. To kind of have this sort of framing around human rights in Cuba or overthrowing or having regime change in Cuba, I thought was actually quite appalling in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, the ABC is supposed to be our public broadcaster and really they should absolutely know better. I mean, the fact is, though, I mean, ABC very much kind of, you know, reinforces the kind of ruling class kind of narratives at the end of the day.
Yep.
But it was still kind of, it's still kind of outrageous that, you know, there was not even a mention of the fact that Cuba's under severe economic blockade. And also at the end of the day, you know, I know that within the left, there people have different kind of criticisms of the Cuban government and the Cuban leadership, etc. But even if you took all the worst things that the Cuban government have apparently kind of done, at the end of the day, Cuba is just a small island nation that represents actually no threat to the rest of the world.
Well, I don't know. If you've got a small country that's on your, not far from your coastline, that has got, that used to have before these recent sanctions, one of the best healthcare systems in the world, despite all of that, you are a kind of a ideological threat.
Yeah, there's that, obviously that ideological threat, but I think the fact is, from any kind of rational kind of perspective, Cuba represents no threat to the world whatsoever.
Yeah.
Whereas what the United States is doing on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Is absolutely
outrageous.
You know, outrageous.
Outrageous. Whereas, Cuba is like a beacon of what we could be doing, spending money on healthcare. Healthcare in Cuba, completely free. People from, like, veterans from the US traveling to Cuba to get medicines because they can't afford to buy them in their own country. So, was a symbol of what could be. And I think that threatens Trump in particular, but all, and Rubio and all of those warmongers in the US.
Well, I'm just going to go play a quick announcement. We have some time to play a song before our next interview. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth. And the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare and spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media, and the industry of media is a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So I'm going to go play a song by Me Simones, and this song is titled I Can Do What I Want. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
I'm trying.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on Free CR 855 AM. And so you're just listening to me, Simone's. And now we're very happy to be joined today by Ali Keshta. So Ali is an Iranian-Australian writer, and he is a political activist based in Nam, Melbourne. He has lived in exile for over 3 decades and is a former political prisoner and survivor of the death sentence in Iran. He's also been, you know, a very active voice against the war in Iran, and has actually written a number of articles for his own Substack and also for publications such as Green Left. So good morning, Ali. Sorry, good morning, Ali. Can you hear me?
Yes, good morning, and thank you for having me.
So to kind of start off, what can you tell us about some of the current developments that have happened with the United States war against Iran? And in fact, I'm noting there was, I think, some recent developments that just happened only yesterday.
Yes, I think that the important point is that, that the war... is not over, and in reality, the war has not ended, and it's simply just changed the forms. Yes, as you said, we have, we have periods of reduced direct confrontation, but even in the past week, there have been reports of the U.S. strikes in southern Iran and retaliated Iranian fire against U.S. forces. So, militarily, the conflict is still simmering beneath the surface. But more importantly, the economic, strategic, and geopolitical dimensions of the war are continuing very intensely. At the moment, Washington appears to be hoping that negotiations can achieve, but military escalation failed to fully secure, namely containing and maintaining Iran while extracting at least some strategic transitions from the country. But from the Iranian side, there is deep distrust toward negotiation. Many inside of the Iran see diplomacy less as a part of the peace and more as a tactical arena where both sides buying time and preparing themselves for the next confrontation. And I think this points to a larger issue, in my opinion. The crisis in the Middle East does not have a simple diplomatic solution. Diplomacy can temporarily raise tensions, but it cannot resolve the underlying struggle, because this is ultimately a conflict over the regional hegemony in one of the most geopolitically important checkpoints in the world. The Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz are not just regional waterways. They are arteries of the global capitalist economy. Energy flows, shipping routes, military logistics, global inflation, all of these are tied to what happened there. So when we speak about the war in Iran, we are not speaking easily about the isolated regional conflict. We are speaking about the struggle over the architecture of the global power itself. And that's why I think we are entering a prolonged phase of the hybrid conflict, economic warfare, cyber warfare, intelligent operation, sanctions, proxy conflicts, and so on. The real danger is that people hear that the word of the ceasefire or negotiation, and imagine that the structured drivers will have disappeared. But in reality, it's another thing.
Thanks, Ali. This is Mary. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Just before I start, I want to say your two articles in the latest Green Left are really, really interesting, and I urge listeners to read them. But my question is that some commentators are saying that what's happened is a defeat for US imperialism. What's your political assessment?
I think in some extent I agree with this, and also I understand why also people are saying that, because clearly neither the United States nor Israel achieved their original objectives. Iran did not collapse internally, the state structure survived. Regional escalation produced major instability for global markets. So, yes, there are elements of the strategic failure here. But I want to approach this from another angle. I think one of the most important lessons of this war is that the meat of the American security guarantee has been seriously damaged for a decade. Gulf state spent enormous amounts of the money on U.S. airlines, U.S. weapon system, and U.S. military protection under the assumption that Washington could guarantee regional stability and security. But this war exposed something very different. What we saw was that the United States could not fully shield even its close allies from the regional instability. In fact, the situation increasingly shifted toward Gulf states themselves becoming responsible for protecting American bases, infrastructure, and strategic interests in the region. And this has implications for beyond the Middle East. I think this war shook confidence in the entire architectures of the U.S. Lead military alliance. Even countries like Australia should pay attention to this very carefully. A military and defense pact such as AUKUS are presented as stable long-term security guarantees, but this war demonstrated how fragile this alliance system can become once a major regional confrontation escalates beyond control. At the same time, Iran emerged from the conflict in a more aggressive strategic posture. One of the most significant developments was the increased use of the Strait of Hormuz as geopolitical leverage. Iran demonstrated that it possesses the capacity, or at least the credibility, threat to disrupt one of the central arteries of the global economy. And the changes of the balance of the power, because now the global economy itself becomes vulnerable to escalation, in a sense, Iran's hands are now closer to the throat of the global capitalist system than before the war. And importantly, this leverage did not emerge dispute the war. It emerged through the war itself. Now, does it mean U.S. imperialism has collapsed? Oh, of course not, but the United States remained the dominant military power in the world, but I do think this war revealed a deeper crisis of the hegemony. America still possesses immense military forces, but its ability to impose a stable political outcomes is weakened, and I think that distinction is very important.
Thanks for that, Ali. I mean, I think that's actually been, you know, that's a kind of really useful kind of overview of how we kind of look at the whole foreign relations and the kind of role of imperialist powers like the United States, you know, because I think, you know, there has been, I think, a bit of an embarrassment of the United States, you know, the fact that they haven't been able to achieve their military goals, the fact that there's been obviously a certain backlash against Trump as well from the rest of the other Western European sort of capitalist sort of powers as well. And of course, now we just had an interview early on in the program with Alan Jennings talking about the Cuba situation. We're now sort of seeing the US trying to gear up military intervention in Cuba, clearly because they feel like they can be the need to be the world bully of all oppressed nations around the globe. But I think the next question to kind of go into, and this is something you wrote about for Green Left, the war on Iran has very much obviously been, as you sort of mentioned, has been obviously at a major cost to the global economy. But, you know, while that is true, there is this whole question of class. And you recently published an article for Green Left where you state that the Australian government has turned the United States and Israel's war against Iran into a class war against the people. Why do you think that is the case? And,
because I think that it's very obvious that always ordinary people end up paying for the imperial wars in the whole of the history and currently. Governments fund military expansions through the public resources and major energy and cooperation never simply absorb lost cause of instability. The cost of the transfer downward onto the society through inflation, food price and transport costs, rent, the mortgage and everything living expense. We are already seeing this in Australia as the energy prices rise, the shadow of the inflation and economic pressure being spreading across the entire society, and working class people pay first for hardest. When oil prices rise, it affects everything, of course. Transport, food, disruption, electricity, everything. So what being as a geopolitical conflict abroad, rapidly become a social conflict at home. And that is why I said the Australian government has effectively transformed the U.S. and Israel war against Iran into the class war against the ordinary people in Australia. Because government asks working people to carry economic burden of the geopolitical project they never chose. Australian workers and ordinary people should, of course, they should to say very clearly that they don't place the cost of the your wars onto the onto our shoulders. We are not the machinery of your military system. Historically, imperialist war in Western countries often generated economic crisis, and economic crisis almost intensified the class conflict over the wages, housing, rents, mortgage, etc. So the relationship between the militarism abroad and social inequality at home is very direct. And that is what I say in my article.
Yes. Yes, very interesting article. Finally, do you have any comments on the role that Israel has played in the war? And do you think Israel is in a stronger or weaker position as a result?
I have written another article in response with the New York reporters that they try to say that Trump was manipulated by the or deceived by the Netanyahu into the war. I don't think this is the accurate analysis. It is true that the Israel intelligence, particularly Mossad, appears to have made serious miscalculation about Iran, but this was never simply Israel dragging an unwilling American into the conflict. The United States needs Israel as a regional enforcer, effectively as a strategic policeman protection of American interests in the Middle East. So Washington can concentrate more heavily on the East Asia and a strategic confrontation with China. But for Israel to perform that role, it must remain the dominant hegemony military power in the region. And from the perspective of the both Washington and Tel Aviv, Iran represent the center obstacle of the project. Without neutralizing Iran as a regional force, Israel cannot fully stable its own long-term regional position, and arguably cannot even permanently stability the situation inside Palestinian itself. So I see the war as emerging from the shared strategic objectives between the United States and Israel, considering Israel regional dominance, which supporting resistance movement, with suppressing the resistance movement in Palestine and across the region. At the same time, it is also obvious that Israel could not wage a large-scale confrontation with Iran without massive American support. In my view, without U.S. military, intelligent and politically backing, Israel would struggle even to the sustained long-term confrontation with resistance forces in Palestine itself.
Yeah, so the final kind of question I want to kind of ask is, I'd like to thank you for being on the program. Do you have any kind of final comments you'd like to make?
I think one of the dangers of today is that the war is increasingly normalized. People are encouraging to think that this conflict as a distance strategic game between the states, but in reality was reshape entire society economically, politically, and psychologically. And that is why anti-war politics today cannot simply mean opposing bombs after they fall. It must also mean opposing the economic system and geopolitical order that continuously reproduce military instability and permanent crisis, because in the end, ordinary people, whether in Iran, Palestine, Israel, Australia, or everywhere else, they are the one who should pay the crisis of this struggle over power and the hegemony. And that's my last point.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ali. It's been great having you on the program. And, I think this has been a very useful kind of discussion.
Really excellent.
And I think very much with our program, we've sort of covered a lot of the important developments happening in the world today with the war in Iran and the threats that US has made against Cuba. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ali. Bye.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we're just speaking to Ali Keshta, an Iranian Australian, about the whole war in Iran. And I actually, I thought that was a very kind of useful kind of overview of what has been happening, because there's a lot of, I think, moving parts to what's happening with the US war against Iran. And I think probably the one important thing I think that Ali sort of mentioned is this whole question of class war, I think is going to be a really important question, because at the end of the day, the capitalist class is in this very precarious position where, you know, where most people, most working class people are living with declining living standards all across the world. And this is the consequence of neoliberal kind of economic kind of policies. But then you have in the rise of the kind of far right like, you know, in the form of one nation in the Australian context. But then you have this other contradiction where, because of the capitalists' own sort of decisions, especially in terms of the war on Iran, which is causing global economic instability, the capitalists at the end of the day are not just going to want to wear those costs themselves, they're going to likely put it on us.
Well, as Ali's saying, they already are. And I think his comments about how it changes society, wars change society, is a really important point. Because economically, he says it's going to change, or already is, you know, through the economic crisis that workers in Australia are experiencing. And also psychologically, in terms of people accepting that millions of people have to be displaced or die in the interests of the economic drives of the US and its and the ruling class.
Okay, so let's go play a quick announcement and then we'll go on to the Green Left activist calendar.
Kefias are Palestinian scarves and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefia to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefias.org.au, that's kefias.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So this is now time for the Green Left Activist Calendar. So here are some of the upcoming events, and including protests, public forums, fundraisers that are happening. A lot of these events are also listed on the Green Left Activist Calendar. So the first event I want to highlight is there's going to be a picket against Ansell and End Modern Slavery, and that's going to be happening at 1 p.m. at the Ansell head office, 678 Victoria Street in Richmond. Then at 7 p.m. there is going to be the Radical Book Club hosted by Socialist Alliance, and this will be the Red North, the Poplar Front in North Queensland, and that'll be happening at the Resistance Centre, level 5, 407 Swanson Street. Then on Saturday, May the 30th, there's going to be a rally, Save Public Housing, at 11 a.m. at the State Library, and that's been organised by Save Public Housing. Then the other event I want to highlight is there is going to be a Rising Tide 2026/2027 strategy at 6:30 p.m. online, and that's on Monday the 1st of June. Then on Wednesday, June the 30th, there's going to be a film screening of Our Warrior, the story of Robbie Thorpe, at 6 p.m. at The Factory at 19 Belgium Avenue in Richmond. And then on Sunday, June the 7th, there's going to be the rally, 59 years since the Naxa, and that's going to be happening at 12 p.m. at the State Library. Now, the other events I just want to highlight on Saturday, June the 13th, there's going to be a fundraiser, Night for Cuba, at 7 p.m. at the Retreat Hope Hotel, level 1289 Sydney Road in Brunswick. And then the next last event I want to highlight is there's going to be a film screening of Tuntura at 6:15 p.m. at the Simonova, which is quite a prominent sort of a documentary about Nakba. On Saturday, June the 20th, there's going to be a rally on World Refugee Day, Fight for Refugee Rights. That'll be happening at 2 p.m. at the State Library. And then there'll be a fundraiser, Solidarity Forever, A Night of Cultural Descent. That'll be at 6 p.m. at the Maritime Union of Australia, 46-54 Island Street in West Melbourne. And you can get more information about that on the Green Left website. That's all the events. Anything that you want to add, Mary, that I might have missed?
No, I can't think of anything.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. I keep putting your wrong mic on. So
it's a plot so that I don't get to speak.
Nah, so there's nothing more to add?
No, I can't think of any other events. Sorry.
Yep. Okay. Well, we have our next interview at 8:10 a.m. But I actually thought maybe we could play a quick song. So this is "Hurts to Love" by Beach House. So we'll play that for the next 4 minutes, and then we'll go on to our interview. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And that was Hurts to Love by Beach House. So we're now very happy to be joined today by Ethan Floyd. So Ethan is based on Gadigal land, and he was one of the participants of the Global Samud Flotilla. And so, yeah, many of our listeners probably have been following what's happening with the Global Samud Flotilla, which was very much a kind of a big act of solidarity, you know, from more than 50 countries attempting to kind of bring aid to Gaza, which is currently under occupation and denied any kind of, you know, basic goods by the Israel occupation forces. So good morning, Ethan.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So Ethan, can you give us a kind of a bit of an overview about, you know, how the flotilla kind of went. I'm aware that there were essentially two waves of participants. You were part of the first wave that I think got intercepted early and had to kind of return essentially back home. And then there was a second wave where many of the participants there got, you know, brutally mistreated, tortured, sexually assaulted by the IOF. And they have only just recently, those wave kind of participants only just recently returned at the start of this week. So yeah, if you can give me a bit of a kind of overview of the flotilla, that would be and also how many participants there were.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the flotilla, as you say, is an attempt in response to the call from Palestinians in Gaza to deliver aid to break Israel's illegal naval siege of Gaza and I think challenge the idea that Israel should be allowed to act with impunity against a state which they are occupying, that being Palestine. So look, this flotilla, you're right to say it was in two waves, but we were the same group of people. I've been back in Australia for about 3.5 weeks now. We were first setting sail from Sicily, and then as we sort of got a little bit across the Mediterranean towards Greece, we were intercepted by the Israeli Navy. So there were about 186 of us who were taken aboard an Israeli prison ship, and alongside myself, there were five other Australians, including Zach Schofield, Neva Connor and Bianca Webb-Pullman, as well as Surya McEwen, who was joining his fourth flotilla effort. We were held on board that prison ship for about 3 days before we were disembarked in Greece. From Greece, the flotilla set sail again, but there were some of us, including myself, who had been, you know, abused and who had been tortured by Israel to such an extent that we were sort of declared medically unfit to continue on the mission, and so I was sent home to Australia.
Hi, Ethan. It's Mary here. Can you talk more about the treatment of the flotilla participants and also what the response has been internationally about this illegal kidnapping of the flotilla ships and the people on them and the way they were treated by the Israeli so-called defence force?
Yeah, I mean, I can start by saying the international response has been disappointing. We've seen a few governments who have come out with milquetoast objectively, but in the relative scheme of things, quite good statements of condemnation of the treatment. And there I'm speaking about Spain and Brazil. You may have also seen some quotes from Maloney in Italy. But by and large, what the flotilla effort has, I think, continued to expose is the complicity of governments the world over. I mean, the Israelis and the Greeks made a deal in order to disembark us in Crete and allow for our deportation through Greece rather than through Israel. And sort of it's the same with countries along the Mediterranean who we were within their search and rescue zone. We put out Mayday calls, and those Mayday calls were not responded to. So I think the international response has been, telling of the global complicity in Israel's genocide. In terms of our treatment, for myself, I can speak to my experience that the violence was immediate. I was separated from my crew on board our sailboat when we were intercepted. And I was interrogated by three Israeli commandos for about 20 minutes. And any time I refused to answer a question or any time I answered a question in a way which they thought was, unsatisfactory, I'd be beaten, I'd be kicked in the ribs, I would be punched in the shoulders, in the upper arms, in the back. When we were taken off our sailboat and transferred to the prison ship, we were put in what's called a stress position. That is, you're made to kneel on the ground. Your hands should be behind your head and your fingers interlaced, and your forehead needs to be touching the ground at all times. And if you shift from that position, if you move or wriggle or adjust yourself or worse, try to look up and see around you, you're kicked again, you're punched. There could be a boot in the small of your back forcing you back down. And in my case, and in many others' cases, the muzzle of a rifle on the base of your skull that forced you back down into that stress position. From there, we were made to crawl along the side of the boat to a passport control station. Once I'd had my identity checked, I was forced up against the wall, and there was an Israeli flag hanging on the wall, and I had someone grab me by the back of my head, by my hair, and force my face into the Israeli flag, and I was instructed to kiss the flag. I was called a terrorist. I was sort of humiliated and degraded and made to, instructed to kiss the flag. When I refused, every time I refused, my head would be slammed into the side of the shipping container. And this happened 8 times, so that left me dazed and concussed and with head trauma, which has resulted in a tremor in my right hand that has been ongoing for the last month. So it was pretty brutal treatment, and your listeners will have seen just some of that treatment in the videos put out by Israeli's National Security Minister Ben-Gavir. I can tell you that if this is the kind of treatment, if this is the kind of cruelty that Israel is willing to commit to film and share with the world, I would really like your listeners and everybody to reflect and imagine what they're doing to Palestinians when the cameras aren't rolling.
I mean, probably one thing I'll just add a bit of a quick comment before I go into the next question. I mean, on all the solidarity with you, Ethan, I mean, especially with what you've kind of gone through, I think it is just incredible, all the volunteers on the flotilla, the fact that they've been willing to go that far to put their bodies in line, risk, some of the worst kind of trauma and, even risk of death, really, because the first flotilla I'm aware of that happened early on, I think around 2006, Israel actually got away with killing more than, I think, how many was it? It was 6 to 7 activists who were part of the flotilla.
And people have gone on repeated trips. That's so amazing.
Yeah, and I think, it's the kind of solidarity, I think, that Palestine, the Palestine movement very much demands. And I think, all the gratitude to it. I guess I kind of want to make one quick comment and then go into the sort of next kind of question, because this comment kind of relates, I think, to the next question. But, I mean, this whole thing about Ben Gvir, I mean, there's this whole propaganda point that's sort of coming from the establishment about this, that, Gvir is just, he just represents like... Gvir. Gvir is just one rotten apple within the Israeli kind of system, because, the Australian government has sanctioned him and another kind of far-right minister. He only just represents the sort of far-right of Israeli society and so on. And, Israeli political society is actually quite diverse. And I think, we have to kind of reject that, because at the end of the day, what he represents is actually what Israel is. It's fundamentally, I don't think there has been any real condemnation of how you and the other flotilla participants have been treated by Israel. And let's not just forget, at the end of the day, the entirety of the Israeli political society and all the politicians are complicit in the genocide that goes on against the Palestinians and the continued occupation and settler colonial project of Israel. So that goes into the kind of next kind of question, which is, can you comment a bit on some of your thoughts about the Albanese and Wong's response and the government and the Australian federal government's response to flotilla? You can even comment on, how much the government actually assisted the Australian participants in the flotilla.
I should mention first the case you mentioned, the previous flotilla mission in 2011. That was the Mavi Marmara mission, in which there were 10 Turkish participants who were killed by Israel, just to make sure we got it. But with what you say about Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's national security minister, there's been this sort of swift condemnation from Netanyahu and others, as well as elements of the pro-Israel lobby here in Australia, which say exactly what you've characterised, which is... that he's a bad apple, he doesn't reflect Israel's values, or isn't an accurate kind of characterization of how Israel approaches these kinds of solidarity missions. I think it's the opposite. I think that Ben-Gvir is quintessentially Israeli. I think that he represents so accurately Israeli values. I mean, this is a person who spent most of his life as an extremist settler. This is a person for whom there are biographical accounts of him taking women on dates back to his apartment, and his walls are plastered with sort of shrine-like images and effigies of settler terrorists in Israel. So this is a person who I think embodies absolutely what Israel fundamentally is about, which is violence, which is occupation, which is dispossession, and which is a rabid grounding of all of those actions in racism. That's who Ben-Gavir is. And so I think it's important for all of us to not accept the response from our political leaders, which is to say, well, we've sanctioned this one individual, and you know, if we can just get rid of him, we can sort of reform Israel and you know, turn this rogue fascist state into something we can call a friend more proudly. I mean, you know, Ben-Gavir is the power broker for this coalition government that Netanyahu leads. The reason Netanyahu is in power is because others like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and the right-wing factions within the Likud are in this sort of, you know, dirty grand coalition with Netanyahu. So remove Ben-Gavir. It doesn't change the fact that this coalition government is propped up by others like Smotrich and other ministers who share this sort of rabid racist sort of terrorist ideology, which is Zionism, which is extremist, the ideology of extremist settlers. In terms of the response we've gotten from Albanese and Wong, it's been much of that in terms of how they've dealt with Israel and how they've dealt with the actions of Israeli ministers and Israeli soldiers. I mean, what we need to recognize is that it's not Ben-Gavir who constructed the prison ship we were held on. It's not Ben-Gavir who personally trained each of the soldiers who tortured and sexually assaulted Australians and 400 other international activists. And it's not Ben-Gavir who single-handedly sort of tills the ground and digs the shovel in every time a new settlement is established in the Golan Heights or across the West Bank. I mean, this is something that he is an expression of a very broad and very entrenched system in Israel. And so the thing that I want our political leaders to wake up to is that fact. And the sooner we can force that to happen, the sooner we can deal with the actual problem, which is how do we unpick systems which exist in Israel, but also crucially the systems which exist here in Australia in our own backyard to prop up and support Israel's genocide.
Yes, absolutely. Any final comments? But I also wanted to ask, would you be prepared to go again on one of the flotilla?
Absolutely. In fact, I tried to, but I was you know, told it would be too dangerous. I was in too bad of a state. I was quite concussed with head trauma. And you know, when those other folks departed, I was here in Australia working as ground crew. I mean, Surya McEwen, who we mentioned earlier, this is his fourth attempt to break Israel's blockade. Mm. I mean, there is a criticism of the flotilla that it's a repeated action, that we should stop doing them because it's not working. What I would say to that is, if every social movement in history only ever tried every tactic once, we would never have seen the kinds of social changes that we've seen over the last 200 years. I mean, the way that we fight these battles is to evolve and to develop in our tactics, but also through this sense of persistence and challenging things again and again and again, not just as a one-off, because that's what we call performative activism. So that's my kind of response to that idea that's thrown out, that notion that's put to the flotilla. I think it's absolutely worth it. I think that those of us who have privilege in society, I mean, I look the way I do. I carry a Western passport. You know, I'm young. I don't have a mortgage. I don't have caring responsibilities. These are all privileges that exist within the scope of our society. And if you don't recognize your privilege and use those privileges, leverage them to do something which is good and right, I think that's a failing. And that's why in approaching this flotilla, the thing that I've been coming back to is this, that my conscience won't allow me to not do something, to not to sort of inadvertently quote Mario Savio, but to not to throw your bodies on the gears and not to put yourself on the line for a cause that is good and right and is rooted in justice and equality. So, you know, we've said that this is the largest civilian humanitarian mission in history, and that's true. But there's an important qualifier that I have to place on that statement, and that qualifier is yet. That we have continued to see over the last 20 years these flotilla efforts grow and grow and grow. And Israel told on themselves this time. They told on themselves in their public statement. They said that they intercepted our flotilla so early, you know, 600 nautical miles, more than 1,000 kilometres from their shores. They intercepted us early to cut down the size of our fleet. That's what they said. to reduce the size of our fleet, because I think that they know what we know, which is that if our fleet at its size, you know, more than 100 boats, more than 1,000 people, was allowed to pass unimpeded across the Mediterranean, I think Israel knew that we would break that siege. And we are currently in the best position we've ever been in. We have the best chance we've ever had to break this siege, to punch through that blockade, to deliver aid and show the world that it can be done. Show the world that we can actually stand up to Israel in a meaningful way, not through milquetoast political statements, not through diplomacy, but through actual, effective, direct action. So my call to all your listeners is, next time you hear the call out, if you've got a bit of fire in your belly, if you feel like you want to do something about what you've been seeing on your phone playing out for the last 3 years, call us, text us, get on a boat, sail the Med. We want to see you on the water.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that, Ethan. I think that's we're actually running out of time for our program now. We've got programs about to wrap up in 2 to 3 minutes. We'd like to thank you so much for being on our program. And I think that is actually a very inspiring message to kind of end the program on. And yeah, I think all the solidarity to you, Ethan. But I also think it's very, what has been, I think, great about what this global Samud flotilla has shined the spotlight on is, you know, at the end of the day, I think the message that you've sort of given that, you know, whatever kind of has happened to you and other participants, it obviously pales in comparison to what the Palestinians go through every day. And I think that is a very important message. We can't stop. I think the important message is we can't stop fighting for Palestine. We can't stop. Yeah. We have to keep speaking up for Palestine, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, what we're up against is a power structure that is much greater than any one person can do. And I think, you know, all the solidarity to the participants of the Global Summit of Florida, it's very much part of a very important global movement for justice.
Yes. Thank you, Ethan, for speaking with us.
No, thank you both. Appreciate your time.
Bye.
Bye. All right, so we are getting to the end of the program. I mean, actually, just wrapping that up, I mean, I think this is actually probably one of the best Green Left radio programs we have done in recent times, like in terms of the diversity of the interviews that we've covered. I think, yeah, between the interview of Alan on Cuba, with Ali Kashtar on Iran, I think we've very much covered a lot of the really important global movements and events that have happened in the past week. So yeah, I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in this week. I also want to make a bit of a plug. I mean, the kind of stories that we're giving you on Green Left Radio are the stories that you do not hear in the corporate media. We're very much trying to highlight, you know, resistance against the injustice of capitalism, but also trying to give a hope that we can actually fight for a world beyond capitalism. And yeah, to really, Green Left very much relies on the support from our supporters. So if you could consider becoming a financial supporter of Green Left, you can become a supporter for as low as $5 or $10 a month. You can go on greenleft.org.au/support. But also importantly, this has been broadcasted to you from 3CR Community Radio, and we want to keep Community Radio on the air along with the other fantastic programs. You know, we do rely on financial support as well, so you can become a subscriber of 3CR by going on 3cr.org.au, or you can even make a donation. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crap.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.